All right, we're going to turn to the second of Acts because we're going to complete what we started last week regarding David. As you will see from the statements here in the second of Acts, David is a most crucial character in the Bible. And whereas it's very difficult for any of us to really function with abstract thinking, philosophical thinking, it's very difficult for any of us to do it without error, because words are often very difficult to pin down, because they do have a variety of meanings, and they have a variety of contexts in which they're being said. So when we think that we can talk philosophically about the things of God, we are probably kidding ourselves about our capacities mentally to organize data, in fact, our capacity to collect that data accurately. The only way you can think is by collecting data in your mind, just like the only way you can run a computer is to put the data in it. You can't step up to a computer yet, at least, and ask questions of the computer without having first put the answers to the questions in there one way or another. The ingredients for the answer, at least. You see, your brain works like a computer. And the data is fed into it from thousands of experiences and exposures that you have daily. And that exposure, whatever it is, gets written on the brain. This thing called subliminal advertising is a threat to society in as much as those flashes of information or that flash of data that is on the screen for a moment. If you see it at all, it's going to be inscribed on your brain. The more conscious you are of events and information, the more conscious of it that you are, the more deeply it is ingrained on the cortex. If you are constantly exposed to a certain kind of data, it's just going to go in so deeply that it's going to be difficult to get it out, and that's what we call a habit. It's something where the groove is like a rut in the road, you see. The more you pass over that rut, the deeper it gets. And you get grooves on your cortex that are so deeply ingrained that you can't function apart from those. We are so impressionable in these matters that the cortex just gobbles up this information. The sad part is we can't always be certain that the information we're getting is sound. That's where old wives' tales come in. Old wives' tales are those things that, those thoughts and ideas that people have gathered over the years that have no foundation in fact, but they are so deeply ingrained in the mind that people just assume it's truth. If you say a thing often enough to a person, they may get to believe it. Of course, that's the basis of propaganda. That's what goes on in the newspapers daily, propaganda. They're saying that if you say something enough over and over again to the public, they're going to believe it. One of the latest farces in the newspaper was an article that came out of this last week, I think it was, about the view of theological seminaries toward the resurrection of Christ. And it was just such trash and such baloney that I couldn't believe it. It's not worth an answer, although I didn't write a letter back to them because I felt that my name wouldn't mean anything to them, but I was hoping that some of the fundamental or evangelical seminaries of the country might respond. There are lots of seminaries in this country, lots of institutions of higher learning, some of them of great note, that believe in the... Now, I'm referring to an article in the Times, I should go on to say. An article went at great length to say that no scholars today, reputable scholars, and no reputable seminaries believe anymore in the deity of Christ or the resurrection of Christ. And it was such gross misapplication that I was hoping some seminaries, at least perhaps someone like Billy Graham, might get into the act whose name means something. Seminaries would have responded. I would have been grateful. I attended Princeton Seminary and still keep up to a degree with their situation, and I would say that whereas some of the professors at Princeton might question certain aspects of the Bible and aspects of Christ, and I do not regard Princeton Seminary today as one which I would send a young man to for evangelical scholarship, but they do not go along, would not go along with the tenor of that article. But this article was very pointed in saying that there is no longer any, there are no scholars that are at least honestly speaking out that believe in the resurrection of Christ from the dead. And saying to you that our minds are very susceptible to inaccurate data, and it is with that inaccurate data that we have to make continual judgments. Beyond that, we don't know everything about every subject. The gaps that we have in that system turn the computer into oatmeal. If you try to set up a system with a computer, a program, you've tried to program the thing, and you miss two or three parts of the puzzle in it, you might as well throw it out. It's nothing. It's zero. We have a very highly overrated sense of, or over-exalted sense of our capacity to think and act logically. We're just all wet about that because we have too many gaps in our knowledge and too much misinformation to really function accurately in human judgment. Now the Spirit of Christ must over and over again, fill in that gap for us. Now, God is not putting a premium on ignorance. I'm not saying to you that you can just empty your brain of everything that's there and God comes and puts a new brain in or a new set of data. What He does is help you pick up on the right data and sense what is not right data. What He does is guide you through that maze of misinformation and come to you with truth. The difference between truth and data is vast. You may have the input of some accurate data and still not come up with the truth if you're missing a few links in it. You may have 10 absolutely valid facts upon which you're making a judgment, and the 11th piece that is misinformation will throw the whole thing off. So we're fools to think that our own logic can do anything for us. On the other hand, God works through our brain. It's as an instrument, it's fine. You don't throw the computer out just because it's been badly programmed. But you do try to make up for the programming in different ways. And I say to you, the human mind has not accumulated an infallible set of facts. Rarely on any subject that you study or deal with, almost no subject you deal with in the range of human activities that you are really getting 100% accuracy in. Now, applied to the issue of the Scriptures, of our knowledge of Christ and our function as Christians, we come as close as we can to accumulating accurate data from the Bible. But in the last analysis, the only way we can come to truth is to get it directly from the Word and to get the Spirit, have the Spirit take that Word and apply it. The only question you have to ask yourself as you listen to what we're saying here is, does this seem to come from the Spirit? Does this have integrity in it? Does the Spirit witness to me that this is right? And coupled with that, or confirming it, is that we are saying here what the Scripture is saying. As accurately as God lets us know what language is all about, we try to say what the Scripture is saying. So now we're coming back to David, and I'm going to take from the New Testament the application of David, which God is making to us. And incidentally, the whole matter about the computer and the brain, the Lord pressed upon me to say to you, but it is in preparation for helping you understand that we are sunk here in our teaching of the Word if we are only going by my logic or by my own ability to read the language or to interpret it to you. We've got to go on far more than that. We've got to have the Spirit come through me and witness to you that what is being said is right and true. Now, going back to the book of Acts, verse 22 of chapter 2, men, Israelites, hear these words, Jesus the Nazarene, pointed out to you by God through powers, that is, acts of power and wonders and signs, which God did through him in your midst, even as ye yourselves know. This one, by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God, the appointed or declared counsel and foreknowledge of God, was delivered up. You, through lawless hands, have crucified and slain, whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by the power of death. For David said unto him, now we come to David. Remember, I said to you that the whole Bible is marked by David. The impress of David is there because, in the first place, the whole course of Israel's history was affected by David. In the second place, all the Psalms are constantly repeated throughout Scripture, the Psalms of David. And in the third place, the prophecies of Isaiah draw David into them in a primary sense as the one through whom Christ received his kingship, his spiritual kingship. And incidentally, the earthly kingship had long since vanished. Jesus would have, if he was merely laying claim to kingship from David as the heir to the throne, he would have been in about as much position to be heir to the throne of Israel at that time as some descendant of Tsar Nicholas of Russia would have the right today to walk into the Kremlin and say, wait a minute, all you fellows clear out because I'm now the king. See, I've got a letter showing that I am a descendant of Nicholas II. Now, the first thing that would happen would be he would be immediately spirited to prison. And the second thing, he would be annihilated from the earth. Jesus also, the moment he would rise up in the praetorium, and say to Pilate, I am the king of Israel by law and right, and I intend to make that stick. I've got my men waiting out there in the woods. What would happen to him? He wouldn't get out of the praetorium. He wouldn't get off the dais. That'd be it. That was the very thing Pilate was willing to go along with Jesus because he came to the conclusion that Jesus was not indeed pressing for an earthly kingdom. The kingdom that Jesus inherited from David was a spiritual kingdom, and the ministry of David to Israel and to the Gentiles today was a spiritual ministry. And it is, as I've said to you over and over again, a tremendous thing for us to realize that God so greatly worked through a man who had as much human failure as we do. Side by side with David's spiritual greatness is David's fleshly failure. And this is why I've made such a strong point in the booklet and in other messages to you. I've made such a strong point. The flesh and the spirit have to be kept in their right perspective. And I've made the point to you that you can be having a tremendous spiritual involvement with Christ and yet there be a clash with Satan in the realm of the flesh. The matters of temper and the matters of weakness of all descriptions are battles you go through daily in the flesh, but they do not dethrone Christ in the spirit. Do you think Jesus Christ keeps his satchel packed? And 10 times a day walks out to be dethroned from the king's position? Do you have to run outside the citadel and say, hey, Jesus, come back. I didn't mean it. Come on back. It's okay. You can live here now. Well, there are a lot of teachings that make that seem to be the way. People show diagrams and everything else. Now Jesus is on the throne, now Satan, now Jesus, now Satan, and playing musical chairs. When Jesus takes over the kingship in your heart, He takes over the kingship. He sees so weak that every time you raise a finger against Him and say, no, Jesus, you're going to run out? No king in history does that. They may be driven out in some earthly kingships, but if they are, they're weak. Jesus is not going to give up the throne of your heart to Satan just because you say some careless thing or do some careless deeds. Lordship and kingship are in the hand of the Lord Himself. Queen Elizabeth is the most prominent example of the royalty that we have today. There are not too many around. But she is there, and she's a weak example because actually England is what they call a constitutional monarchy, and her position is, in a lot of respects, a figurehead position. But still, let's use her as an example and say to you that subjects in the British kingdom do not feel that because they violate a traffic law over there or because they do some deed that isn't acceptable, that they have now caused Queen Elizabeth to leave the throne of England, or that they have themselves left the kingdom. See how important this is? David did many things that were distressing to God and to himself. And his hands were so red with blood that God did not feel he was a fit one to build the temple. But that did not keep God from identifying with David's heart. And he said, the thing about David is the heart. And that's what God thinks about you. It's your heart. He knows what is in your heart. You are weak and I am weak. We make mistakes. But when we come back to Him knowing we make mistakes, say, Lord, look, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. He forgives us. That is your hope and consolation. The moment you try to defend yourself and say, well, I'm not so bad. I'm, you know, after all, other people are as bad as I am. So forth. That's where you lose out with God. When Saul defended himself to Samuel, that's when he lost the ballgame. King Saul, remember that story in the first book of Samuel where Saul was ordered by God to slay this particular nation and its king and all the sheep and everything in it. And Saul had a bleeding heart experience there, and he couldn't bring himself to do it. Now, the reason God did this, the wars of Israel throughout the Old Testament are symbolic of the war with Satan. It's symbolism. The whole of the Old Testament, from one end to the other, is a history of wars and battles and conflicts of one kind or another. They're all wars from Satan. Now, we've given you that about Goliath. David's battle with Goliath was not intended as a simple history of the physical battles of Israel, but as a spiritual symbol. Goliath is the giant that represents Satan to us. Satan comes to us in the appearance of a giant. He deceives us by his appearance, and we think he's a lot bigger than he is. We think he's monstrous and totally invincible, as Goliath seemed to be to the run-of-the-mill soldier of the armies of Israel. They looked at that man and ran before him, not realizing or thinking of it as a spiritual battle. But David saw that. David saw the spiritual side all the way through. And he saw Goliath as one defying God. He didn't see Goliath as one hurling a challenge to some warrior. The challenge was to God. And David said, God will fight it. That's what he said in that 1 Samuel 17. He said, this is not our battle, it's God's battle. It doesn't matter what I use for a weapon. The weapon made no difference at all. It could have been a bone like Samson used to kill 1,000 Philistines, or it could have been an ox prick, a goad that Shamgar used to kill 600 of these Philistines. Or it could have been a clay pot and a lantern that Gideon used to destroy the armies of the Moabites. It doesn't matter what the Midianites, right? It doesn't matter what the instrument is. What matters is who's using the instrument. If God is doing it, he can take anything you've got. The question is, what do you have in your hand? Moses had a stick, a rod, a shepherd's crook. He delivered Israel with that shepherd's crook. The little lad in the New Testament had 5 rolls and a couple of sardines, and Christ fed 5,000 or 10,000 people with it. If you figure the men plus the women and the children, at least 10,000 people. Jesus fed the multitudes. Just what do you have in your hand? The widow of Zarephath had a little bit of oil. With it, she saved the life of the prophet and her own son as well. I've just been studying this with David. It's a marvelous thing that I said in his article that David used a slingshot. Now, in the modern church, what would we have done? We would have established a slingshot school for giant killers. That's exactly what we would have done. Somebody goes out and has a little success with an approach in evangelism. What do? Write books on it and pass it around to the world. If I can win somebody with that method, you should too, you know. Ridiculous. Many religious organizations, many evangelistic organizations have a pitch. You memorize the pitch. Some of the biggest in this country, evangelistic organizations, the first thing they put in front of you to join their organization is the pitch they use, and you've got to memorize it. I heard this right from the directors themselves. You memorize this pitch, because I've been able to win people with this. One fellow, whose name you probably would know, said to me personally, I will guarantee to my workers that if they will use this pitch, they will have success in, I don't know what he said, 9 out of 10 cases. And I saw the box scores coming in, you know. So many saved this week. So many of this. So many decision cards come in. Using that method, because it's an effective method. If the salesman uses it, we can use it. I've seen notebooks after notebook of people publishing their system. And they've got memory joggers in it. They've got everything in there to help you remember the points they use. Because it's effective. Saul himself, or the greatest warrior in Israel, had used David's slingshot, he would have been destroyed. The slingshot was for David, not for Saul, not for Gideon, not for Samson, or Shamgar, anybody else. The slingshot was for David, and nobody else would be able to use it. Because it was God behind David, and the slingshot was a symbol only. That's the message God gives us today. What do you have in your hand? Whatever it is, bring it to Christ, and it'll be enough to do what He wants you to do. It will not be enough for you to do what somebody else tells you to do. It will not be enough to do what you project that God wants you to do. You can't pass it on to anybody else. You notice we never do that. I never give you manuals. I never tell you how I did it, because I didn't do it. There'd be a lot of people that would like me to come and give them some help on how to do this kind of thing. I have calls a lot about that. People want to know how to do this, you see. Well, we can't. This is something that God does, and anybody else trying the same thing would fall flat on their face. David is singular because he obeyed God. Now, back to Saul. You see, Saul was appointed by God in protest. God did not want to appoint Saul. God was ruling Israel through judges. He did not want to have a king. But they pressed him and he let them have the king. Again, God stepped in to try to save their failure. He did not agree with what they were doing. But on the other hand, he said, well, if you'll still follow my will, my word, I'll deliver you. Well, the matter of Israel's survival was such a fragile thing that only God could save it. Israel was a tiny little nation on a tiny spot of land in the midst of grand nations of that day, of empires with large armies and large amounts of land, and that struggling little dot on the map, Palestine or Israel, had no hope of survival whatsoever apart from God's grace. And all of the ways that God used their abilities emphasized over and over again that, in effect, they couldn't do anything. So somebody signs on to be the security guard of the place, and you call for them and say, we need a security guard here. We want somebody that can really take care of the prowlers and so forth. And what we want you to use for a weapon is a banana. We don't want any guns around here. So we give him a banana. And he says, well, you don't want a warrior. You want a produce man. So I'm leaving. David is going to go out to fight Goliath. What does he have? He has a banana. He has an apple in his hand to throw at the giant. It's an insult under normal conditions. What God was saying is, it doesn't matter. It's a banana, an orange, a stick, a candle. Now, their only hope was absolute obedience to God. It was the only hope they had for survival. Now, remember, it's because they were so weak that this obedience becomes an absolute necessity. Egypt could afford to go against God in the flesh. Now, they couldn't ultimately, you understand that. But they could come out pretty well in almost any battle apart from God. Today, there are many men who are wizards in the financial world that everything they touch turns to money, and they're totally against God. You could never build a case for saying that God prospers those who are his children and gives what for to the people that don't follow him. Sometimes the men, as Jesus himself pointed out, sometimes the men of the world were smarter than the people of God. And so there's no case here. People have said to me, well, I don't need the Lord. I mean, look at what I've got here. I've built all of this. Now, Saul thought that he was mighty enough to do his own choosing. When God said to him, now here's a nation I want you to wipe out. That didn't look very holy to Saul. Saul did not want to obey that command. But I went into that matter of the spiritual warfare because I wanted you to know that God did not just arbitrarily wipe out nations. But the nation he was telling Saul to wipe out was going to be a continual heartache to Israel, and he thought you better get rid of one apple so you don't spoil a barrel. That's a principle I've followed and God has followed, or led us to follow over and over again. And I followed it in years that I taught in high school and college. Sometimes there were a few mischief makers in a class that were never going to come under control. And if you leave them in there, they'll spoil it for 30 other people. So as much as you'd like to help them, you have to say, well, wait a minute, I've got another loyalty here to look after. Maybe this person needs help, but I can't help them at the expense of 30 others. Now God was saying, God was saying, I can't save that group alive because the wickedness of that group is such that they will pollute all of Israel. So I have to wipe them out. Now that does not have anything to say about the eternal destiny of the souls of those people. There were children that were slain. And one will say, oh, well, how can God be so terrible and cruel to slay those children? I'd like to put it the other way. How can God be so cruel to leave the children alive in this rotten world? You know, in other words, to slay a child may be his greatest release, rather than have him grow up in a society that was brutal where he might be offered up to the gods at any time anyway, put into the fire, and these children were offered up all the time in that civilization. Well, God had his reasons for wanting it wiped out, but Saul thought he knew more than God about it, or at least thought he was more merciful than God. That's usually the angle Satan comes to us on. Well, we're more merciful here because even though that person is in a spot there, we would like to, ask God to save them. Well, the point is there comes a time when God's attitude toward things just has to be followed whether we agree with it or not. So Saul, not in agreement with the order, saved alive not only the king, Agag, but also the sheep and some other of the people. And when he met Samuel, who was God's spokesman to Saul, Samuel was the prophet that gave instructions to them, Saul came with a great smile on his face. Say, you see, Samuel, I did everything God told me. And just about that time, one of the sheep started bleating. And Samuel said, is that so? Then what means the bleating of that sheep? I hear something here. You didn't do what you were supposed to. So then Saul backtracked. Rather than coming to Samuel and saying, look, Samuel, I'm sorry, it was a mistake. Let's wipe him out now. He defended himself. Well, Samuel, he said, I really thought that we ought to have something to sacrifice to God, so on and so on and so on. So Saul said, Samuel said to Saul, look, Saul, he said, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. I want to tell you, if you don't know it yet, Christians in this world will be wiped out apart from God's grace. I don't just mean in terms of the worldly circumstance that we are in, but in terms of the spiritual life that we have, apart from the grace of God, Satan can wipe you out any day of the year or any hour of the day. Satan has enough control of the forces of this world that he can tear you in pieces any moment. And we've been the object of his attack at times. And but for the grace of God, we could not sit here this morning in any degree of peace and safety, because Satan is mad against the Christian and will wipe him out spiritually or physically or psychologically anytime. So if we start talking about how great our equipment is, we're fooled. Say, well, I've got a pretty good brain. God intends me to use it. Well, David could have said, I have a great slingshot here and God intends me to use it. Yes, but only at his direction. Only at his direction. God has to communicate to you through a brain. You couldn't think without it. That's the only way he uses it. He communicates to you through it. If you think the brain you've got is adequate and the data you've got is enough to put the pieces together, you're just kidding yourself. Every thought you think apart from the Spirit, is full of baloney, practically. And even the highest in their professions understand this. How many times has the medical profession, for example, had to absolutely reverse all their thoughts about what they were doing? And here's some poor soul who's been under their care for 20 years, and all of a sudden they find out that they were wrong for 20 years, now they've got to reverse the treatment. Do exactly the opposite. There isn't a brain in this building or in this world which, apart from the Spirit of Christ, can come up with any kind of a choice or a decision that's worth the powder it would take to blow it up. Because we're just faulty thinkers, that's all. But the Spirit of Christ can take the data that is there and assemble it properly and fill in the gap and give you a pretty good choice. But it's got to be his choice. Now that is where David came out on top. There isn't a church in the country that wouldn't have tarred and feathered David and ridden him out on a rail if they had to evaluate who he was and what he did. But God said, here's a man who knows who he is and stays with me anyway, and he does what I tell him to do. If he can just find somebody to do what he tells him, he's got a pretty good person there. David did what God told him. As faultily as he did it. Now that is why the Bible is filled with applications from David. Because he represents probably more than any man in the scripture the frailty of the human flesh and at the same time the mercy of God that is extended to the man that obeys him. Possibly in terms of moral action, Saul might have been at least equal to David. The difference was that Saul disobeyed God and David obeyed him. That's the great difference. A second difference is that David did not defend himself the moment he knew the truth. He came penitently to God and said, "Look, Lord, I've been wrong. I want you to forgive me." David always looked to God for the answer, for the issue. The crucial issue then with David, and that is the basis, the fundamental basis why we can say the things about David that we are going to say from the second chapter of Acts. I want you to know why God stayed with David and why he will stay with you through thick and thin.